I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With every episode, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers.
Welcome back, listeners.
Yes, welcome back.
We missed you. Oh, we missed you. How we missed you.
Yes, and I missed horror movies, right?
Has it been a while since you saw Hartwell before prepping this episode?
It has been a while. I've been watching some horror TV and like shorter things. I've been reading some creepypastas.
Okay.
These are I have to get my horror fixes in short now.
Yeah, bite size.
Yeah, because you know, my son is old enough that when he was a baby, I don't know, it didn't really matter that much. You know, we watched the Ted Bundy documentary. He seemed to be just fine watching that. But like,
he hasn't murdered multiple women yet.
Not yet, you know. But now it's like, he might now. So let's calm down. So I have to get my little fixes like where I can. So I'm taking horror in very short increments.
I've been kind of mixing, but getting a fair share of horror. It's funny. My mom just brought up the Spanish movie, The Platform, which I did see. Some pretty great Spanish horror there. I've caught a couple things I liked a lot recently. The Shudder movie Haunt, which was an unexpected delight. I don't know. We'll get into more of like what we've been viewing, but we've got a dedicated focus for this episode. We're coming in blazing with Baba Yaga.
Right, Baba Yaga. Now, Darren, Baba Yaga, when I say that before this episode, what would you think about that?
I couldn't tell you when's the first time I heard the name, but I have heard it recently in, you know, out of context places. Baba Yaga is just kind of impressed upon me that she is the like boogeyman of folklore. It comes up in John Wick of all places.
Yes. My mom was telling me that. I've never seen a John Wick film.
They're fun.
That's what I hear.
In this case, John Wick is meant to be the boogeyman, AKA Baba Yaga. The villains in the movie are, you know, Russian oligarch gangster types, and so yeah, it means something for them.
He once was an associate of ours. We called him Baba Yaga. The boogeyman? Well, John wasn't exactly the boogeyman. He was the one you sent to kill the fucking boogeyman.
It also comes up in Ant-Man, Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Like a ghost.
Like Baba Yaga.
Baba Yaga, the witch. They tell stories to children to frighten them. You know Baba Yaga?
Oh, you don't find someone like that. They find you.
Like Baba Yaga.
The woods?
Ah! Oh! Baba Yaga!
Whoa! Whoa! Baba Yaga, come at night. Little children sleep at night.
When he talks about the Baba Yaga, it is meant to be the kind of thing that haunts children's dreams.
Yes.
But yeah, I didn't really have a frame of reference. Now that we've kind of dug in a little bit, I think there are almost like positive equivalents of, say, like whatever the opposite of the boogeyman is, right? Like for kids, it's Santa Claus.
Sure.
And I was thinking in terms of these original stories in their first form. Kids, say, like, for every Santa Claus, there is a Sinterklaas or a Krampus, and, you know, along with them is Black Peter. And so the tradition that, like, Americans hear the idea that Santa Claus steals the bad children and kidnaps them and takes them away and beats them in a sack, like, that is shocking to us, but commonplace for other people. Because the kind of legends, like, we come up with the Disney version of everything. Like, God forbid, you know, a parent reads to their child the original Little Mermaid, it's grim. It's pretty upsetting, and there's some pretty great villains in there.
Did I tell you about my Little Mermaid thing? You know how sometimes grandparents get you the wrong freaking thing as a gift.
I like where this is going.
Like Lego, and they get, you know, Duplo, or I think it's Duplo. I don't know what that is. I only got Lego, thank God. But you know what I'm talking about. Well, I wanted the Disney Little Mermaid when it had first come out on the cassette squishy VHS, you know, tape.
Yeah, yeah, those soft cases.
Yeah, you know the ones. So that's what I wanted. You know why? Because I wanted to watch it and I wanted to put it with my other Disney films. Good, great. My grandmother, oh, she got me the Hans Christian Andersen, some other sort of version of Little Mermaid, which is the real Little Mermaid. Traumatizing. It is so sad.
Yeah.
She turns into sea foam, surprise. And it's freaking awful.
Yeah. And so those original stories, before they were Disney-fied, Baba Yaga is going to present in more westernized media as like, yeah, the witch and Cinderella or even, right, you know, Snow White. And so she is kind of the archetypal witch, but like in the original form, I thought it was really interesting that she's not, you know, she's not just a straight villain. She's certainly not like completely misanthropic. You know, there are plenty of versions of her stories where she's right, actually helping people.
She can be good. She can be bad. You're always going to be changed whichever way you come in contact with her. You're coming out learning something a little bit more than you knew before. And I think very archetypal of America loves a very clear cut good and bad guy.
Yeah.
I think America loves that. Don't mix it up. It's good or bad. And when you get these Eastern European stories and these Russian stories, there's a little bit more gray area, I think, in some of that. And Baba Yaga, from her early, early beginnings, obviously going both ways, then once propaganda films start to really take place, 1939 and clear up to the end of the USSR, then she kind of fulfills this very propagandist role, whatever they need to describe her as. And so again, though, she's going kind of both ways. And that I find is very interesting, that more her story, the story of this fairy tale, is really changed by propaganda. And I find that to be very cool.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I haven't really dwelled much on the idea that they talk about the like fall of the Soviet Union being one of these points where like she does kind of spread out into culture beyond, you know, Russian and Eastern European. And yeah, I mean, that certainly speaks to the propaganda edge, that she is kind of a multi-tool of a villain. Like, you know, she can, you know, teach the kid a terrifying lesson, or, you know, the way they describe her in best case scenarios is that, like, you know, she might be your only hope if you're lost in the woods. If like you're a person with a good soul, then she'll hook you up. There's a small handful of these specific stories that get told and told and told. And one of the ones where she kind of, you know, you see a little bit of the duality is the story of Vasilisa, where this young girl is in the woods. I'm abbreviating the story quite a bit, but she's in the woods. She is essentially a Cinderella character whose family, you know, are removed and dislike her and punish her and are mean to her. She winds up in the woods and encounters Baba Yaga's home, which we'll go into more depth, but the beauty and fascination of a house on giant chicken legs that can pick up and walk away whenever it chooses. She comes upon Baba Yaga's home in the woods, and she's distraught, and Baba Yaga offers like help to return this girl to her home. And something of a, I don't know if she's promising a solution to her family trouble, but in order to find her way home, Baba Yaga takes a skull that is one of the fence posts of her home, kind of gives it light, and it shines Vasilisa's way home. When, yes, Vasilisa gets home with her skull lantern and the little flickering flame inside, it becomes a blowtorch flamethrower and sets her hated family on fire. Problem solved.
The end. And I think it's great. What's funny about it is at the beginning, like it would make like kind of a great TV show, this Baba Yaga, because not only like Vasilisa's like, oh, I'm so sad, my stepfamily's so mean to me, blah, blah, blah. And Baba Yaga like berates her for being stupid enough to lose her torch in the beginning. And so that's all Baba Yaga promises to do after she realizes, oh, this girl's just stupid. I'll give her some light. And then, yeah, then it becomes this blowtorch of justice. But it's kind of funny, like, before she helps her, even though I think Baba Yaga maybe even at the beginning makes up her mind, like, I'll help this person, but first I'm going to tell them how dumb they are. And to me, that is such an Eastern European grandma, if I've ever heard one. She'd be like, yes, I will help you out of this predicament, but I'm going to make sure you know how dumb you are to be here in the first place. And so I don't know. There's something very, to me, Eastern European, or in this case, like Russian, about that. And you're like, and you just take it as a young person. You just go, cool, grandma. Keep on keeping on.
And I also love the, like, the Twilight Zone element, the, like, you know, the monkey's paw element where, yes, I'm going to, she doesn't say anything about keep this away from other people or anything to that effect. When her family starts being set ablaze, Vasilisa is just as surprised as everybody else. She didn't know this was going to happen. So that is that. That's a moment where, like, Baba Yaga's got to be looking like, yeah, I didn't say I would help you find your way home and you would live happily ever after. Everything comes at a cost.
Yes, but she does still then marry the Tsar and live happily ever after.
Silver lining. That's no more family interference.
I don't know. He must have heard about this blowtorch and said, you know what I heard? This woman's amazing. Let's marry her.
So one of the places that I recently came across Baba Yaga is that she kind of plays a mini boss in Hellboy. And it's funny, it's only, I'm putting it together now, but you asked me, like, you know, what's my first recollection of even, you know, the name or the idea. And it actually was in Hellboy comics. It was in one of the trade paperbacks. I just put it down. It's in The Chain's Coffin and others. And it's a really short story, but in the way that Hellboy, especially in the, like, early days of the comic, balances elements of folklore and then either builds or focuses on specific things. In this case, Baba Yaga, you know, Hellboy speculates that she's responsible for children's disappearances, because that's kind of the worst of Baba Yaga, is the idea that she will snatch naughty children. So that's why Hellboy is in this, you know, dark Eastern European town, and he finds Baba Yaga in a cemetery where Baba Yaga is counting the fingers of dead men. And so Hellboy watches her do this for a second or two, and it turns out that, like, that part is actually, that's based in the folklore, the counting of fingers, which made me thinking this is just, like, you know, accumulated horror in my head, but we talk about it quite a bit, that, like, in the original lore of vampires, they're obsessive compulsive.
Right.
They will count if you give them a reason to.
I think she's more like a hoarder, though.
I could see that, but I think there's also something to the idea of, like, the demonization of certain mental illnesses, and the idea of, like, the moment you're counting, like, you're the other. And Baba Yaga represents that to a pretty, like, real degree, as far as, like, being, you know, the outsider. She's kind of the original wild woman in the woods.
Absolutely.
And to keep, like, I thought the counting of the fingers and the sort of suggestion that she might be OCD, I thought was really interesting, just in the way of, like, how they attach something like that to, say, like, early vampire lore. In this case, you know, Baba Yaga, the evil spirit in the woods.
This idea of the other is kind of reminding you of Freud's uncanny, which we've talked about when we actually talked about Night of the Living Dead, and zombies actually represent this idea of the uncanny as well. Yeah. But there's an article called Who's Afraid of Baba Yaga? A Reading of Aging from the Gender Perspective for the Institute of Social Sciences, Ivo Pilar, Zagreb. It's an awesome article if you want to go looking for things. It's that idea to me of saying, okay, Baba Yaga is scary because, yeah, she eats people. She lives in a swamp and she's all by herself. But the reason she became this scary thing, or we came up with this as a group conscience kind of thing, is that we're afraid of old people, especially old women. It's terrible in most societies to be old. It's even worse in most societies to be an old woman, because your value is low. Right? Yeah, low is what I would say. And Baba Yaga really represents that, because she could be good. She can be that really nice grandmother, or she could, you know, eat your children. But that's why we shouldn't go finding old people, because, uh-oh, watch out, they're scary and they do scary things. And I thought that was an interesting article.
Yeah, they describe Baba Yaga as the ambivalent mythological heroine, which I guess, again, like, there's so many versions of her stories, but you never really get the impression that she's looking for trouble.
Right. It's people just wander up on her. And clearly, she's got rows of skulls leading up to her house on chicken legs. Like, nothing of that says, I'm going to go knock on that door.
Right. If you had any other choice, you wouldn't. Yeah. Yeah, that the versions of, you know, that dichotomy between, like, the warm and welcoming grandmother who you, like, cook with versus grandmother who maybe doesn't like kids. Maybe that grandmother, maybe she's got a couple whiskers and you get really eked out when, like, you're forced to hug her. Like, I'm not saying I had one of those grandmothers.
But you know the kind. Everyone knows the kind. It's the, right. The scary old man who lives in the house, you know, and get off my lawn kind of a thing.
Yeah. And it's a unique fear that that inspires. And I don't know, maybe deep down in someone's unconscious, it reminds you of death. And I think that's one of the things that, like, why in this case Baba Yaga gets demonized, or why old people get demonized, is that reminder that, like, they're that much closer to death than you are. And right. That is what you have to look forward to. So let that haunt you for a while. Like,
because it is that idea that we don't talk to our old people like people. We kind of talk to them like you talk to your grandparents, generally in nice ways and with kind of kid gloves and everything. But, like, your grandma could have been, like, dancing on the table at, like, Studio 54. You never know. But you don't want to know that, I think, in a way, because in society, you don't want to know that they were like you, because then you'll be like them.
Right, right.
And that's, like, so sad. And that's why I love kind of, like, I talk to my grandmother, especially my Eastern European grandmother, I do a lot of cursing when I talk to her. And I talk to her just like a peer of mine. And I love that because I know her in such a different way, I think, than most people know their grandparents.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's, like, there's a value to that. This grandma, though, she is the one who told me about Baba Yaga, the one that I'm talking about.
Okay, how did she present her?
She used to threaten with the Baba Yaga. And that's how I know a few things other about Baba Yaga. There's a couple ways to get out of Baba Yaga putting you in the oven. Did you know this?
I don't think so.
So she doesn't just outright eat you. She's not a savage. She's going to cook you first, Baba Yaga. So she has you sit on a spatula oftentimes, I assume it's like a pizza spatula, you know, like a big thing. Uh-huh. And you go pushed into the oven. However, if you sit in a way that you don't fit in the oven, she'll be like, you got me. And you can oftentimes walk away.
Okay.
I call it the OJ defense. If you do not fit, you must let me walk free.
All right. Baba Yaga has terrible depth perception, or even just, like, spatial relationships present a problem.
Terrible spatial relationships, absolutely. And then, also Baba Yaga, I don't know if you read any of these, sometimes her hands can come off and go do other things. That's cool as hell.
I love that visual. Yeah, that's, so I feel like there's a missed opportunity to really put all these together, because you get bits and pieces. So, like, the Hellboy movie, was that only last year? I think it was only early last year. Time has stopped meaning anything. I mean, we can take a moment to sort of address that, like, we're in the middle of a pandemic, everything's happening remotely and at home, and weekdays look a lot like weekends.
Yeah, I have no clue. I've been, like, unemployed because the gyms are closed for over a month now, and I don't know what day any day is, and it doesn't really matter.
No,
I feel like the Dowager Countess. What's a weekend? It's a little Downton Abbey joke for everyone.
So in the Hellboy movie, we get a couple great visuals of the Baba Yaga. She plays this sort of mini boss. You know, Hellboy needs to interrogate her in order to get to the big baddie. And so we do get her house on long chicken legs.
Baba Yaga.
And once you're in the house, then you get a good look at Baba Yaga, whose wooden legs She kind of pivots around, and those long iron teeth.
Don't you look lovely?
Most think me grotesque. An old hag with one eye.
Oh, no, not me.
Probably because you did this to me.
They don't, however, bring in the mortar and pestle, which I guess it's come up in video games. Yeah, as a visual, like, it's pretty wild. So it seems before there was the traditional, you know, witch riding around on a broom, it was Baba Yaga riding inside a mortar and pestle, and she kind of uses the pestle as, like, her steering kind of rudder.
It's like a rudder, yes. Yeah. But she also has a broom, and she uses it to cover her tracks, which I think is ingenious.
I love that. I
like
love that.
Baba Yaga's following her.
Right. Always looking out for the cops, Baba Yaga. She's So going back to the idea that American culture certainly likes to linger on the positive as far as, like, you know, kids are concerned, especially these days. Think of the children. Think of the children. And so everything is Disney-fied and the edges are sort of shaved off. And so everything presents nice, that the child's upbringing should be nice. But in the olden days when, like, you really had to scare the hell out of a child so that they don't wander in the woods, like those days where it really takes fear to enact discipline.
Sure.
This word comes up in the second article, the Identifying Impressions of Baba Yaga, Navigating the Uses of Attachment and Wonder on Soviet and American Television, by Megan Armnich and Jill Terry Rudy and Sibelian Forrester. They use this specific Russian word that doesn't really seem to have an American counterpart, but the Russian word is vipichlenia, and I'm sure I'm butchering that, but the way they talk about it is the kind of imprinting that happens in childhood that becomes this, like, cultural cornerstone, this shared shorthand that everybody kind of experiences. So that as an adult, you hear the word and, like, it might send a chill down your back. And in America, it occurred to me that, like, I don't think I was ever actively frightened, say, the way your grandmother tried to scare the hell out of you with Baba right. Yaga threats.
As you do.
But I thought that was a really interesting idea that other cultures, I mean, I think there's... Even in American culture, like, I think back to, like, more, you know, maybe one or two generations back, if your, say, grandparents aren't from the old world, then maybe your great grandparents are. But, like, whatever generations back, when it was okay to scare children, so long as there was a point, there was a moral, there was a lesson to be learned, this was useful. This idea of this, like, common fear, this common threat. And as horror fans, I kind of wish I did have something like that.
Yeah, I don't feel that there's an American equivalent to something like that where we all know this thing.
No, there's cartoon villains. There are the villains who, like, you can guarantee are going to get their comeuppance. But there's never any, I mean, nothing I've come across suggests that, like, Baba Yaga was beat out by the townspeople or, like, she was defeated and Baba Yaga was no more. I think even in the Hellboy comic that I had mentioned, the graphic novel, Baba Yaga, in this case, Hellboy, you know, in the encounter, he fires off a shot and hits her in the eye. Later in the comics, she comes back and takes Hellboy's eye. That's a longer story. But he kills her in that moment, it seems. And the animals in the woods have this conversation about how Baba Yaga is dead. I went to where her house was and there was nothing but a pool of blood. And the Russian bear responds, "She has gone far away, but do not be afraid. Are not her iron teeth and wooden legs this country's bones? Do we not eat her food and breathe her air? She is our mother and can never die so long as Russia endures." And I think, I don't know, I kind of love those stories that we occasionally get to when we delve into other cultures, where in this case that, like, this is, you know, Russian folklore before there was a Russia proper. And right. That's why it kind of blends, right? It's not exclusively Russia. It, you know, you hear some, like, Eastern European extensions of the stories and some of the vocabulary is a little similar, but a little different. Even in, like, you know, some areas of Scandinavia, they've got Baba Yaga lore. There's something about the wild lady in the woods story that really, I don't know, it kind of gets under my skin a little bit. I dig it. But it reminded me specifically that Clay McLeod Chapman's newest book, The Remaking, is kind of a, like, old world Virginia urban lore American Baba Yaga. And it is the, like, woman in the woods who, you know, going far enough back, she was kind of, like, castigated and winds up living in the woods so that she is left alone. Except when, say, like, the townspeople need help on the DL for things that they can't go to their local doctor for, they go to her. And in this case, you know, she helps a, like, mother-to-be or, you know, a woman who wants to get pregnant. And, you know, mixes up the herbs and local vegetation and gives her, like, a fertility treatment. Things go awry. You know, she kind of overdoes it and it goes bad. And so that's the figure at the center of this story who, you know, kind of goes on to haunt the story. But again, someone who is ambivalent, who needs to be approached by other people asking or looking for things to really be engaged.
And the story of Baba Yaga, to me, reminds me of The Mother of Toads. Is a short film that is part of the Theater Bazaar, the Udukir Theater Bazaar.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, I think, one of the first films in that. And she kind of goes out of her way to get him in this, but it kind of reminds me of this, like, this swamp lady and kind of this cool idea that oftentimes Baba Yaga, she's, like, nice old, and then she gets, like, gross old. But in The Mother of Toads, she's, like, good looking, and then she's, like, a toad evil witch person. But there's something about that feeling that really reminds me of that. And that's based on an H.P. Lovecraft story. But it's still something that kind of gets you in that mood of swamp lady all by herself. And to some extent, even the witch, if you remember, well, that was everywhere, yeah, the witch, you know. This idea of a woman out in the woods by herself because she's been sort of made to go out there.
According to the internet, the first written reference to Baba Yaga was in 1755 in a book called Russian Grammar. Baba has been translated as old woman or grandmother, and that's more to the Russian side of things. But if you're being mean about it, it could mean hag, depending on which Slavic language is being referenced. And Yaga or Yaga is harder to pin down. It seems the word can mean horror or shudder in Serbian and Croatian, anger in Slovenian, or witch in Old Czech, wicked wood nymph in modern Czech, witch and fury in Polish, and serpent or snake in Sanskrit. So, like, that is, I mean, in the way that, like, witchcraft imbues words with, like, this deeper meaning, like, it's got sticking power.
There's a lot going on. And Yaga also can mean, it's these, like, little statues are called Yagas. And that's a kind of interesting idea that Baba Yaga's, you know, like, maybe like a statue come to life, or this idea of, like, a creepy, scary statue that has then this whole story around it. That's kind of, I think, an interesting idea.
It does have that element in common, right? That it, like, needs to be activated. Like, Baba Yaga,
she's just doing her own thing until someone messes with her.
Right, yeah, she's not looking for trouble. Trouble has a way of finding her.
Oh, poor Baba Yaga. Wah, wah. So we chose two forms of media to go along with this idea of the Baba Yaga. And for me, when I especially hear it as someone who grew up in orchestras and was a pianist, when I hear Baba Yaga, I think of Modest Mussorgsky. Always think of that, because his big piece, the big one he's most famous for, it's called Pictures at an Exhibition. Mm-hmm. The ninth movement is called Baba Yaga.
Yeah.
Now, have you ever heard it? Did you ever hear it, Darren, before?
I probably have. I recognized parts of it. And then I think John Williams is probably just borrowing heavily from Mussorgsky. But yeah, I don't think I had heard the piece on its own ever.
And so first impression, what did you think? So last week we requested people listen maybe to this piece because it's only 3 or 4 minutes long before they listen to the show this week. What did you think about it first here?
It reminded me of a Pixies song in the way that like it goes loud then quiet and then loud again. It's really dynamic, and you're clearly, you know, even before looking at the video that you sent that has the musician sort of breaking down the elements, and there are very specific visuals that all the musical elements are accounting for, even without his explanation of that, it clearly felt like Mussorgsky was scoring a film in his head. It was 60 years before a film was ever invented. And so it does have that element that, like, it's so dramatic and, you know, specific at times. Like, it does get very quiet.
Right.
And then it explodes again and, you know, it builds momentum. And by the end of the song, I dug it a lot. I really liked
it. So let me give you a little background kind of history on this piece and kind of what Mussorgsky was thinking maybe when he wrote it. Mussorgsky himself is a sad story. A lot of these Russian national artists, unfortunately, were because Russia was so closed off and segregated in and of itself that they didn't find fame outside of Russia in the same way that Europe was finding this fame with America, with the rest of Europe. It's very secluded. So Mussorgsky was a depressed alcoholic. That's him.
The like one famous painting of him, you kind of get that.
Yeah, you kind of can feel that. You feel that idea.
He does look like an out of work painter. Yeah, in the mid 1800s.
And the problem with a lot of his things, and especially this one, is that it was after he died that it became famous. That it became a famous piece. So he wrote it originally for the piano, and I think that's brilliant because it's so difficult. It's like a feat of fingers and dexterity just to hear it on the piano. And that's what it originally was written for. And how he got inspired to write this pictures at an exhibition was that his friend named Hartman had died. He was an artist. He had passed away. And there were these pictures. And Mussorgsky saw these pictures and chose 10 to inspire each and every movement of this 10 movement piece. And so there's many different elements. You even have the element of the man watching the art and walking through the art, and that's in there as well. When we get to Baba Yaga, it's the second to last piece, and you think, if you just listen to it, that they must be looking at the Bilbon image of Baba Yaga. But instead, what they're actually looking at is Hartman had done a picture of a clock, and it was a cuckoo clock that was on the chicken legs. It was Baba Yaga's house as a clock, and Baba Yaga's not even in the painting. Isn't that sad?
Now, does that speak to what we were saying earlier, that no need to even show Baba Yaga, just know that behind these doors is the thing of nightmares? Is that
I really do
kind
think
of what's
that
going
I
on?
Think you can get away with just showing a house with chicken legs, especially in Russia, in this very closed off Russia at the time. It's just like they know exactly what they're talking about. They know exactly what is going to put that into your mind. And so I think it really goes to show how deeply ingrained the story of Baba Yaga is, that Mussorgsky's looking at a picture of a clock, but you hear the music and you can see Baba Yaga, the witch, as soon as you hear it.
Gotcha.
What we're most familiar with is the Ravel version. That's what the orchestra version with the multiple instruments rather than just the piano. Ravel took it, cleaned it up after Mussorgsky had passed away. And that's what we get in 1922 is the more famous version of Baba Yaga that we all know and love.
Yeah, I watched both. The piano version, I'm careful to use the word violent when it comes to music, but maybe animated is a better way to describe it. But like, is the kind of piece that you're worried that the top is going to fall down onto the piano. Like if it's, I don't know what it's called when you open the top of the piano and you prefer that sound for miking or whatever reasons. Why do they do that, Mindy? What difference does that make?
Oh, because it muffles the sound or it lets the sound escape. So the stick on a piano, there's like a short version. You could have it closed. You can have a short version. You can have a fully open top version.
Okay. Yeah, I was worried
and
it was going to fall over.
It depends on what you're doing. So if I was playing Baba Yaga, I'd open that friggin' piano up.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I would... You also have the option of not just playing some notes with just one finger. You have the option... In the way that he orchestrated it, and so you can probably imagine that he played it this way. He was a pianist himself, where you can actually take your third finger and like your second finger together to create such a sound. Or you could take even your thumb and your third finger. Maybe if you trained harpsichord, you would do something like that. But it creates this like aggressive kind of sound. And even in the notes, and it's not a program piece. A lot of people think it's that Pictures in Exhibition is a program piece. It's not, because there's not a specific program. There's more left up to interpretation than that.
I need a little more on what it means to be a program piece.
So a program piece is really something that you see in Impressionists, which maybe you would expect from Ravel. He was an Impressionist. And so they give you a program and tell you what to listen for in each piece.
Ah, okay. Like the, what's the
like
famous
Peter
piece?
Peter and the Wolf.
Peter and the Wolf.
Yeah. Okay. And so they'll tell you the oboe is the duck. And that's awesome. This is not that micromanaged. Even though Ravel was an Impressionist, he is clearly doing that, but he's not doing a program for you because Mussorgsky had already kind of just made it the way it was. But it does say at the beginning, feroce. So it is meant to be furious. And I think there is this like agita to the whole thing. And you hear these like bop, bop, bop. And there's so much silence, I think, within the noise that gives it that aggressive kind of feeling.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. I feel vindicated a little bit that like I was taking away from that as like violence.
Yeah,
like
I think it's absolutely some violence to it. And what that does, and you're absolutely right to listen for those dynamic changes where it gets very, very loud and then suddenly what we would say subito piano, very quiet suddenly quiet. Mm. Because that's a horror movie, man.
Yeah.
Right? You got the build up and then you're waiting for the shoe to drop. Or maybe the piano lid to fall.
I was.
Some things I just want the listener to kind of listen for when they listen to this piece. And I think it's all very kind of up to interpretation, but it's definitely worth listening to. You hear these intervals constantly of minor seconds and major seconds. And oftentimes, you know, I'm talking about tritones and saying that's the scariest interval of all. But there's something really great about a major second, because we know that it's very familiar to our ears. And then mixing it with a minor second. Do you know a song that would have a minor second, or a theme that would have a minor second?
Our opening theme?
Oh, well, I'm sure there is, but I think of Jaws. Da 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 da. And if you think about the Jaws theme or that minor second, then you hear the bass line to Baba Yaga. You're hearing those ascending minor seconds, and then they descend and they ascend and they descend. And to me, it's like the idea of her kind of going out and capturing whatever she's doing, then coming back to her hut. And then you do hear this hopping sound, which I think is the chicken legs.
Yeah.
And that idea. And funny enough, another picture at the exhibition, which is a few songs previous to this one, are these chicken ballerina dancers. It's a bizarre, absurdist kind of picture. And that theme is actually in there as well. So you have these big chicken legs kind of in the sound of this bop, 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 bop sound. And then this like dee, 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 dee. And that's the little chickens. And I think there's something like comical about tiny chickens seeing a house on chicken legs and saying like, mama, you know?
That's funny. Yeah, I'm imagining like a clumsier version of Swan Lake.
Absolutely.
But, that's really funny. The little chickens looking at the house. Yeah, that's
there's something
that's
like so
adorable.
Absurd to it, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, all of this is otherworldly. it really does kind of work to its own, like, gravity, its own atmosphere.
I want to remind people, if you go to the symphony, which now we don't often are not going to get to do for a while, right? But if you even go online and you listen to live symphony orchestras playing, read the program notes. Always read the program notes. Number one, someone did a bunch of research to put those together, but oftentimes people don't know that you're supposed to read those, and they'll tell you so much to help you unlock the music further.
That's really cool.
And that's why I really wanted to bring up Baba Yaga as a piece, because I think sometimes people just listen to music and say, that was scary or that was spooky, but there's so much to it, much like a movie, that you can unpack and you can unlock and you can make it more scary than maybe you even originally heard it.
Yeah, it makes it that much more accessible. I'm imagining, I mean, there's, you know, any number of people who don't really dig on classical music because it's kind of like a tough entry point, right? It's tough to come in blind.
Absolutely. And this one, I think, is a great entry way for people. Not only do you hear the chicken, not only do you hear the little chicks, you also hear this idea of like the soaring kind of melody on top, which is clearly her in that mortar flying around.
Yeah, that accompanying visual.
And then thinking, when you listen to it, listen for those minor seconds and listen for that Jaws kind of feeling and theme. You're gonna hear it. And so it's not always about tritones. Sometimes that minor second in Western music, it's our smallest interval. That can be kind of terrifying every now and then. And if you hear this song and you think, whoa, this is pretty cool, I want to maybe learn a little bit more about it, there's the piano piece, which is the original. There's the Ravel orchestration. But then later, Stokowski, who you might know from Fantasia. He's okay. The conductor in Fantasia. He also was an arranger, and he arranged it in a more Slavic way. Ravel gives you this kind of impressionist touch to it, but in the more Slavic, like really understanding of Baba Yaga in your heart kind of way, Stokowski does it, and it's a little scarier.
Okay.
And so instead of using drums, he's actually like making the instruments growl and making it, it's a little more sinister. It's a little grittier. So it's kind of like a remake, if you will, of a film. And maybe it's like the remake of Dawn of the Dead in Dawn of the Dead.
So Baba Yaga doesn't have her own movie. Not really. Not that we think does justice to this character from ancient Russian folklore. However, there are a couple pieces with her namesake.
Yes.
And one of those is on Amazon Prime, free to stream right now. And so let's start with whether or not we would recommend this and work backwards. I watched the first 45 minutes thinking, don't recommend this. I not much enjoying this. It doesn't really apply to our conversation. And then after 45 minutes, it got even weirder. And I was like, I'm in. Where is this going? Baba Yaga from 1973. Mindy, what did you think? Let's work backwards. First, would you recommend this movie?
I would recommend it to like a Bava lover, right? Someone who
Mario
loves
Bava. Yeah. Okay.
Someone who loves that, I would absolutely recommend it. To a normal person, no, I would not recommend it. To a woman, no, I would not recommend it.
Yeah,
it's not good.
No, it's not good.
It's weird, though. You're absolutely right. You know what it reminds me of, though? It's like, it reminds me of in The Big Lebowski when she's like, que ridiculo, that group of characters that's always talking far like above intellectually everyone else, but they're only doing it to be intellectual, not because they actually have these deep thoughts.
I got that feeling too. The idea that there is a subtext to this movie, and it's not even subtext, they say it out loud a bunch of times, but the idea that these are characters who are counterculture, who are in their minds revolutionaries and going against the grain of commercialism and, you know, government fascism. And there's certainly like an anti-fascist theme.
Oh, definitely.
In this story. So they use a lot of keywords.
So what's new?
Not a lot. Your left wingers are continuing to blockade the schools in Milano.
You're a fascist.
And you're an idealist.
Let's go.
You know what? I got the feeling that something was changed in the translation from the original, presuming Italian, even though the main character is French, and so that it has that very 1960s, 1970s style of Italian movie dubbing that drives me bananas.
It drives me crazy, too, because sometimes I think they're literally matching up the words that I'm hearing, but then they're not other times. And I think, were you just speaking French and you're speaking English and you're speaking Italian and you're all on the same set just speaking at each other? And the acting style makes me think, yes, that might have been true.
That was my feeling as well. Yeah. Okay, so Baba Yaga from 1973, directed by Corrado Farina, starring Carol Baker as Baba Yaga,
yeah.
Isabel de Funes as Valentina. She's the French actress I mentioned. Yeah, I felt like there was a lot that was said to be fixed in post for this movie. It's only Baba Yaga in namesake. They do sort of, they do that like kind of Argento ancient witch kind of theme, but it has nothing to do with anything we've described as being Baba Yaga adjacent even.
No, not at all. There was a review that says that she actually, Carol Baker comes off as a, like a sexy Mrs. Havisham. And that's absolutely the case.
Yeah. Some of the reviews were pretty funny. The like Wikipedia page has some of the responses from the time and more recent reviews. But, let's see. The writer Danny Shipka noted that the film is, quote, never uninteresting, and the comic book style in which many of the scenes, especially the sex scenes, are filmed is well handled, as well as that it was, quote, not altogether successful, of a mix of Guido Kripak's Italian comic book genius and European exploitation. So this is based on a comic book. I was joking that this is the only Marvel movie with nudity and adult themes. It was a graphic novel, and the graphic novel makes an appearance in the story.
Yes, it does.
I mean,
I thought you would like that part of it. It's based on the graphic novel called Valentina from 68. And actually, Valentina makes many kind of comics through the years. So it's not just one particular book that it's based on. This character is in not only comics or graphic novels, there's also like a strip, a comic strip that was a Valentina strip as well,
okay.
Which I think is interesting. And there is that idea of that this is a graphic novel film. I feel you can kind of see it in the way that they clearly, some of the sex scenes absolutely are done frame to frame, interstitials kind of added in there, but it's kind of beautifully framed, even just the live action scenes, some of it.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful film.
Where to begin?
I'll start with the opening credits.
Okay.
Watched the opening credits, asked myself, what am I watching? And just like your first kind of thought of like 45 minutes into the film and you're like, no way. I think it was like 45 minutes into the film and I thought to myself, is this even a horror film? Like, what is happening right now?
I mean, it starts pretty tame. And I think where I was first like taken aback is the idea that Carol Baker is playing, I'm going to say it, the sexiest version of Baba Yaga you could ever imagine. Because
it's true.
By what we've described before, Baba Yaga is meant to be the like old hag that is frightening. But Carol Baker, I mean, they kind of pale her up to give her a little bit of a, you know, deadness in the face.
Yeah, she's wearing like concealer on her lips and it's scary.
And I thought it would be great if like there's a moment of reveal where she is in fact like a old gnarled woman, but no, that's not what this is about at all.
I also thought that might happen and it never does. Listener, it never happens. Don't wait for it.
While the visuals are, I mean, it is kind of like an experimental art film. It does have that feel to it. The music, not so much. The music feels like a late 80s soap opera where there's probably too much score and it's piano score that calls attention to itself. There's like one or two themes that you hear throughout the piece. Mindy, is there anything significant about what was happening in the score?
The composer is Piero Umiliani, who's a really famous composer of Italian film, especially those kind of films. He did some Bava films, some other George Eastman films, I believe. That's his style, and it's schmaltz, and it's Pink Panther, and it's like jazz lounge. I call some of that music lowest common denominator music, which is not nice, but there's not a lot really going on besides it sounds like garbage jazz.
Yeah, it was just kind of taking up space.
Yeah, he was a pianist, so that's why you have some of these really great like piano themes that sound kind of like David Foster, but it's, you gotta remember, it sounds kind of like David Foster. You're right in that it sounds like an 80s kind of theme, but you have to remember this is 1973, so to hear that tonality, it's actually very forward-thinking tonality. We just hear it with our ears now and say that sounds like David Foster.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, if we're gonna sort of tie this all together, the visuals of the movie are pretty strong, but the music and not really giving the visuals any breathing room, not really working with, you know, tension the way the Mussorgsky piece works, that like, you know, there are points where like almost everything's gonna drop out and you gotta focus. This movie doesn't really have that.
It's excess. It's excess of everything. It's excess of color and excess of terrible acting, sometimes an excess of nudity and sexual situations and excess of music. It's just all the things. It's like Wagner in film.
Yeah.
The fashion, though, is pretty freaking cool.
Yeah, there was...
Did you notice? It's like beautiful.
Yeah, and that it's not... They're meant to be these like... progressives. And I think in 1973, Italy, I mean, there was like a wave of revolutionaries in 68. And this does feel like maybe the last elements of like free love and the like 1960s counterculture. It finds its way into these stories. And a lot of the characters' conversations are about, you know, what is anti-establishment and what is fascist? And that... The levels removed from then and now, I think, hurt it in the way that it doesn't always make sense. I'm not always sure what they were going for. For example, Valentina has a love interest in the story. He's pursuing her to, you know, less effective extents early in the movie, but he is a filmmaker and or documentarian. We're never fully clear what he's doing, but
he makes commercials though too.
So that idea that I also thought commercial, but I wasn't 100% sure because it might have been racist as fuck. There's a moment where we cut to, I think without explanation, and that's kind of the way the movie works, that like, we're going to show you something. Maybe you'll get it. Maybe you won't. Might catch up. We cut to a very stylized, like, spy versus spy. We've got a guy in a full black suit. He's of African, Italian descent. It's hard to say. But he is on the run from a guy in a white suit who's shooting at him. And they are running around and between large cargo trailers and eventually wind up on top of them. And the guy in white finally kills the black guy. Cut to the guy has disappeared and dissolved, and this might be an ad for clothing detergent. What?
Nice.
Oh, it's utterly fantastic. How did you do it, Captain White?
All right, Fred, now zoom in.
But then there's other bizarre race things that's very strange later on when Valentina photographs her seeming friends, even though the things she's saying are not friendly to her black Italian friend and white lady.
Pretty tone deaf.
So weird.
And now, let me see some nice primitive drive, okay? Like your ancestors. You know, the ones in the jungle that ate up the missionaries.
It's really weird. And I thought to myself when it happened, when that scene happened, I was just wondering what I was watching.
But that's when it got like so crazy that I was like, all right, I could recommend this as a piece. Like you were saying, if you're big into Bava, if you can get into Argento's Witches trilogy, I'm not the biggest fan of Italian horror, so I couldn't fully give it like a full-throated endorsement. Yeah.
It's the thing that we say in our house often is, if you don't understand something, it must be art. So I guess this is really high art, and I just am too stupid for it.
It's high something.
It's very strange. What really kind of gets you is the story goes on. She meets Baba Yaga in the beginning. Valentina meets her because she almost gets hit by a car. And then Baba Yaga drives her home, and it's just really uncomfortable. Everything's uncomfortable. I feel like everything makes you uncomfortable.
If I had
Baba
Yaga
is like this very aggressive lesbian.
Well, you mentioned before this dynamic, which I think is actually how it went down, that all the actors are doing lines in their own language and they're looking at each other like, what? And that's the chemistry of this movie is, what?
I say something, then you say something, and then I talk again.
Like the only thing missing is for them to look off camera to the director. Like, I go now? I go? Okay.
Me? My turn? Me? I will say, George Eastman was kind of a handsome fella, not going to lie.
Yeah, I mean, the movie does have eye candy going for it. There's quite a bit of nudity. I thought it was really interesting that like all the sexuality is kind of out of context of any actual sex. And there's not, I mean, there's like one sex scene, right? It doesn't go beyond that. There's
one
suggested.
Like sex scene between the two of them, but then there's some sort of like BDSM stuff that's relatively graphically alluded to. It's very weird because it's very sexual without actually seeing it. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Maybe that's what like caught me off guard. Well, that's one specific thing that caught me off guard. So the story does kind of wind around, but the ultimate point is that Baba Yaga fixates on Valentina and has, you know, is sort of done some off camera spells with Valentina's garter clip, it seems.
Yes.
Like it's a piece of clothing I'm not terribly familiar with, but that's my best guess. And so when she returns it, she visits Valentina's studio, kind of puts a little juju on the camera that Valentina likes to use. And that I actually like that a lot. The spell over the camera, turning it into kind of a soul gun. I didn't make any sense, but I liked it.
Soul gun. Perfect. Yeah, it was kind of kind of gross how she touched all over the camera. And I think if I was a photographer, I'd be like, get your fingers off my lenses.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you weird. It was very weird. Everything was very uncomfortable. You know what it reminded me of though, a little bit? Carol Baker reminded me of in Once Bitten, the woman in Once Bitten.
It's been a little while. Once Bitten with Jim Carrey. That Once Bitten?
Yeah. Yes, that one, Cleavon Little, yeah. But she kind of reminded me. It had that same aesthetic there. It was really strange. So I got to talk about the scene where Valentina goes into Baba Yaga's house. This is when she's shooting jewelry. She's shooting like photography jewelry in Baba Yaga's house, which why'd you go there? What's happening? I don't know.
Yeah,
don't
think about it too deeply.
And then she finds a hole that's just like hiding under a rug.
Right. Not in a remote spot of the house where no one will tread. It is 10 paces from the front door and next to the central stairs in the house.
Yes.
And there is a carpet over a rug, rather like a Persian rug over a hole to hell.
Well, it's just a hole. And then she throws down a canister from her film and it never hits the bottom. So she just kind of goes, oh, and then, you know, Baba Yaga's like, oh, stay away from that hole. Hey, and she's like, okay, cool. And she goes on her way shooting this thing later.
I was going to say, Mindy, what else does she find in Baba Yaga's house?
Oh, the doll you're talking about. Yeah. So there's a lot of snooping going on. Why is all the snooping And this is something, though, where this Baba Yaga actually has to do with other Baba Yaga, in that don't go snooping.
Ah, yeah.
Maybe that's what this whole movie's about. Don't snoop. Because she finds a creepy sex... It's a doll. It's not a sex doll. It's a doll that's dressed in sex clothes, sort of.
Yeah, it's...
It's in harnesses.
BDSM-style leather work. However, like, this isn't a small doll. This is an American doll-sized doll.
Yeah, American.
And that it does have, like...
What's her story?
Leather cross straps exposing the boobs. Like, it's
Crystal
not...
Crystal comes from 1973.
Not meant for children. That moment, like, you know, Valentina's kind of under a spell to a certain degree. And she also thinks, like, maybe I'll mentally masturbate for a little while until... You know, Baba finds me.
Yeah. I didn't know if she fell asleep or she just like closed her eyes to like think about some things. Like
she did
I was
seem
very
enraptured.
Confused. And then Baba Yaga was like, ding dong, what are you doing?
Yeah. I want you to have this doll. What?
You seem to really like it, you creep. Oh my God. This is the weirdest freaking thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we can leave it off there. Like we said, if you are into 70s Italian horror, and I mean, this movie does have a couple things going for it that, like I said, by the end of it, there's so many ideas just kind of thrown together to see what sticks that I liked it. I liked the overall product. I don't think it's a good movie, but I would recommend it.
I don't think I would recommend it. I really, I know that you already like this kind of film, then I would say, oh, go check this out. You know, I do think there are some scenes that I just didn't understand. I think it was too much art for me, like Jesus and the Nazi and the topless boxing. It just must be some high art. And I am a dumb dumbo.
I think the filmmaker was certainly exploiting the idea that, like, she's going to have dream sequences and they will mean whatever you want them to mean. If, you know, there's, like, Nazi experiments happening in the middle of her, like, unconnected to anything. And like you were saying very early in the description of the movie, I did get a little bit of this, like, patronizing feeling of... Yeah, this movie is progressive and it's made by progressive people and we're comfortable with nudity and sexuality. And if you can't get down with it, then you're a square. We are counterculture and revolutionary and anti-fascist. And it's like, well, I hear you. But what's this have to do with anything?
Yes. From the very beginning, that's exactly my like second after I said, what am I watching? The second thing I wrote was, a lot of words are being said, but I don't think there's anything going on.
I don't think the actors were told what the words mean.
And my favorite quote, probably, fog turns me on. And it was said almost just like I said it, just there. I could have been in this film.
There is a nice little like special appearance of the original black and white film, The Golem.
Yeah. Well, because they're so fancy, they go watch German Expressionism, you see.
Yeah. It's its own date opportunity in the middle of this movie. And so, yeah, I think if it's not already out, then it's their next episode. But the Faculty of Horror are doing German Expressionism, I think, next. So yeah, that's somewhere to look for more of the good stuff. But, so Mindy does not recommend it.
No,
I kind of do just cause I want to talk to people about this movie because it's weird.
Well, you know what? This is something, and I've been thinking, unfortunately, a lot about it. Greasy Strangler, for some reason, during this, like this quarantine, like so much Greasy Strangler quotes have come up.
Really?
And so, yeah, apparently I quote it a lot, and so does my husband. And so, you know, maybe this will come up too. Maybe I'll start quoting things from Baba Yaga maybe in a year or so. So
there's a couple choice quotes that I will have sprinkled into this conversation that, I don't know. This was a lot of like first draft being passed off.
This film was edited down 30 minutes from its original, and he was mad. He was really mad about it.
Yeah, they cut the original. So there's no like director's cut. There is just the original cut that the studio kind of took away from him.
That's probably just as well for everyone.
Yeah, I don't know that this movie needed more. I think they might have kept cutting when it came to, say, the score.
Cut the volume.
Let me speak to you about the anatomy of terror.
So thanks, listeners, for joining us for this conversation on Baba Yaga. Planning going forward, we got some reminders that we're all over social media. We are at Rants Macabre on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And I've got a little bit of news. I finally finished a chunk of music that I have now made available on our website, therantsmacabre.com. It's a 4-track EP called The Rants Macabre. And so 3 of the 4 tracks have vocals. 1 is an instrumental. They're chock full of references and, you know, quotes from movies. And yeah, I don't know. If you're a horror fan.
You're like a Rob Zombie kind of fella. But good.
That's offensive.
I said, but good.
I mean, we forget that Rob Zombie is a great musician. I think, you know what, if anything, I think his movie career is hurting his music. At least in like memory, but anyway. But yeah, so these tracks are for free, downloadable, or streamable on our website. If you're feeling generous, you can find the EP as well as the Apophenia album that I put out in 2016. They're on Bandcamp. If you go to Darren Ty, that's DarrenTy, Bandcamp.com. You can find all the music, including the tracks that Mindy sang on. They'll be free on our website for a while, so you can have a listen. If you're feeling generous, you can track down the Bandcamp link. But the links will be in the show notes. We're putting some shows together. In the previous episode, we did talk about what the future entails. Going to be a dad in July, you know, fingers Yay. Crossed, knock on wood, everything goes according to plan. So until then, we are kind of doing the mad scramble to produce some shows so that we don't have this long gap of time the way we did between last year and now. The hiatus is over.
So we're glad to be back from this hiatus. It's kind of awesome, you know, kind of taking some time off and then coming back. And so we want to say thank you to all of our fans and everyone who's supported us through the years, because oh my god, Darren, how long have we been doing this?
I had to look it up. I did not off the top of my head remember exactly, but we put out our first 2 episodes February 8th, 2015.
So we've been doing this for a long time.
5 years.
And it's awesome that we have you guys with us, some of you from the very beginning, which is very cool, and others we've picked up along the way.
Yeah, and hopefully we keep building. We've got some really nice reviews on iTunes, and listener, if you're feeling generous, you might find us on the streaming app or wherever you found us, whether it's Stitcher or Google Play Music or iTunes or Spotify, and drop us a couple stars and a review. Your reviews help us to grow and share the show. So, drop us a line, drop us some stars, some reviews.
And feel free to tweet us on Twitter. Love getting tweets. And then you could always send us an email, therantsmacabre@gmail.com.
I love watching the map of downloads that we get with, you know, the country destinations, wherever we've got downloads. And, like, it's an international fan base that... it means we're drawing from a lot of different experiences. I'm curious to hear from the people who grew up with Baba Yaga. I'm curious to hear of, like, when you hear Baba Yaga and it gives you a little shiver, or, you know, little goosebumps. What was that like? Like, what is it like to grow up with a boogeyman in the woods? Yeah, I don't know. I want to hear some outside perspectives. But, we're going to be working on episodes for the coming months. And you might have some recommendations or suggestions for what we do next. So we're all ears. I'll leave it there. This is Darren signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks. Dance Macabre. Cutting,
cultured,
and curated.
And curated. And curated. And curated. And curated.